You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored, brought to you by Powder Radio. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week on the program, we have Carl Fosfet. And if you're not familiar with Carl, well, he started his ski career out of Sun Valley, and in his younger days, he was all about urban. He's moved his way out into the backcountry over the past few years, and this year, he's had a lot of early season action that we'll talk about, as well as talk about what he's been up to over the past few years. So sit back and let's talk to Carl Fosfet.
How's it goes it?
Good, man. Yourself?
Good. Just on the road here, driving through Ontario area, about to cross the border into Idaho and heading back up to Ketchum.
And what do you think your chances are in crossing the border with no issues?
We're about to find out. Let me get back to you in about 30 seconds, but I'm about a 50-50 chance here.
Oh, you're literally 30 seconds from the border?
Yep. Oregon is currently thanking me and asking me to come back soon.
Okay. Do you think we should do this while you drive through the border? I have no problems with that.
Yep. It's happening right now.
Nice. Nice. Well, if you have any problems with Border Patrol, I'm very good with them. I don't think I have more than two or three things on my record.
Now, did you cross that border much back in the day? I heard 10, 15 years ago, it was pretty casual to get across the border. And everything I've heard over the last 10 years has just been, you got to have your shit straight or you're going to get hassled.
Yeah, well, you know, I did it. It was all post 9/11, but I do have a great story that I guess I'll share. We're at Whistler, leaving my first sales meeting. You know, I was 24 years old. And in Canada, marijuana at that point, you could get your hands on. So I had some and I was driving back across the border. And I didn't want to try to cross the border with anything in my hands because that's just stupid. So pull over to the last gas station before the border. And I see somebody with their car window open. They're not in their car. They're shopping inside. And I'm like, I'm going to be the coolest guy ever, and I'm just going to drop this little bag of whatever I got left in the back of their car and not think about it, and they'll be stoked when they find it. Well, I get back in the car with my ride, and she's like, so what'd you do with it? Do you throw it away? And I said, no, I put it in someone else's car. And she's like, you are an idiot. That person is going to the border, and they are going to get in trouble. So I have someone to apologize to somewhere, and I hope they didn't go to jail.
Oh man, well, hopefully they got through scratch free, but that's some potentially pretty bad karma there.
Yeah, I don't know if it's come back around to bite me in the ass or not, but let's talk about what you've been up to. In following you all over social media, you've had an early season that's been busier than most people. I saw you were in Idaho with Pollard. It looked like you're doing something with the Kine and Hellies. You skied with Colin Collins, Sammy. You're with good company at Mount Baker. I've said what you've done, but pretty busy early season.
Yeah, it was one of those seasons where every single day has pretty much been a powder day. There hasn't been much waiting for it. I went out to Utah and they had some snow on the ground. We went out, hiked up Alta, and it was still a little rocky, but we were getting core shots and face shots all in the same go. And then Idaho has had a little bit of snow, but they were hurting a little bit. So I hit the road up to Bend and met up with Lucas Walks up there. And when I showed up there, it was just dumping. They had a foot of snow in town, and they since have gotten like 2 more feet out there. And every day out around Bachelor was just unbelievable. Getting out on the sled and just going full white room.
Nice. And it's been like that every day, right?
Yeah, it's been good. And yeah, it's just crazy. Bachelor already has more snow than we'll probably get in Idaho all season. So it's been crazy to just go from 0 to 100 that quick, but it's been awesome. And then we moved up to Mount Baker from there, and they've been getting tons of snow, and met up with the good company filmers, Jasper Newton, and just built some smaller early season jumps to shake the rust and get back in the swing of things and feeling pretty good.
Getting some stuff done early, which is nice to do, try to stack some stuff. But before we talk about what you're up to now, I think it's important to tell the whole story of how you became who you are today. And it starts in Ketchum, is that correct?
Yep. I was born in the old Sun Valley Hospital in 1990 and grew up in the Ketchum, Haley area. Went to Wood River Middle School, Wood River High School, and after that moved out to Utah, and now I'm just moved back to Idaho.
Cool. And when you were growing up, there's like 6 boys in your family, right?
Yeah, I have four brothers and one sister. Two of those brothers are half brothers. We all have the same dad. So, yeah, our dad was pretty busy back in the day.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And does the whole family ski?
All four of my brothers snowboard, and my sister's the only fellow skier out of the siblings, although my dad and my mom also ski a little bit as well. My dad's more into the Nordic skiing, though.
I read somewhere that they flipped a coin pretty much to see if you were going to ski or snowboard.
Yeah, we used to have the whole family get together at this big, long dinner table, and my sister had joined the ski team, and my brother was snowboarding, and I was 7 years old, and it was my turn to figure out what I was going to do, and I had been trying out both skiing and boarding, and I didn't know how to make the decision, and finally, nobody really wanted to push me either way, so we just said, hell, let's flip a coin, and here I am skiing 20 years later.
Did you ever pick up a snowboard, or was it just full-on skiing?
You know, there's one year where I was just loving snowboarding, and I think I must have been 6, 7, 8 years old, right in that realm, and got out a little bit, but I was still skiing a bunch, and all my buddies were skiing, and it just felt like the right thing, so I kind of stuck with that. But in the last couple of years, I've been getting a little more into the board sports. The powder surfing in particular is a ton of fun, especially with the snowmobile. You can go out with your snowboard boots on, and that helps a ton snowmobiling, and then you just have your powder surfer out there, and you feel pretty free out there and kind of naked without all the clunky ski gear. With that being said, I still think that skis are the dominant piece of equipment out there for most applications.
One of your big complaints and what needs to change within skiing is that you need a universal boot that you can ski in and ride your sled because it's just so clunky on that.
Yeah, totally. The ski boots get pretty sketchy. My buddy Wiley, he got his ski boot caught in his sled and right in the stirrup there and got thrown off the sled, and the sled was kind of ghost riding itself down the hill, and he was getting dragged by his leg that was stuck in the stirrup of the sled. And so, yeah, the ski boots with the snowmobile is a pretty sketchy combination. And yeah, you go out with your snowboard boots on and you're just 10 times better at sledding, but you can get by on ski boots too. And everyone has different methods to deal with it. A lot of people are just strapping their ski boots to their tunnel and switching footwear out in the field, and other people are just giving up skiing altogether and powder surfing.
So when you were growing up and you're skiing, were you put into any sort of race program or anything at Sun Valley, or was it just free skiing and having fun?
Yeah, I was thrown into the Sun Valley freestyle ski team when I was 7 years old. I was the youngest kid on the team. And already when I was pretty young, I just loved jumping. And my first year on the team, I got the nickname Crazy Carl, and it's kind of stuck since then. So I've been rocking that name for 18, 19 years now. And yeah, it was a lot of fun being on the team back in the day. Wood River Middle School, starting in sixth grade, would let us out of school early 4 days a week. So I've been getting out of school at about noon since sixth grade. And yeah, I was able to do that all the way through high school. And then college, was obviously able to take semesters off or structure classes around skiing. And so I'm not really counting my days, but I know that since sixth grade, I've probably logged at least 100 days skiing every year consecutively since then.
That's pretty amazing that the school does that for you. And when I think about that, were there any other skiers that were able to take advantage of that program and graduate into a professional ski career? Or were you the 1% of the school that actually it worked out for?
You know, there's a lot of good shredders that come out of Ketchum, Sun Valley area. Colin Collins obviously is a name that comes to mind. And he ended up graduating from Wood River High School and then also went to another school, the community school. It's almost nice when you're going to school till 12 o'clock because you're in middle school and high school. You can't stand that shit and you're waiting to get out of class all day. And so when you finally get out of class, you're just so ramped up and ready to ski. You show up at the mountain and you just have so much energy. It's crazy. Now I have to figure out other ways to get yourself in that same mentality with that, getting that stoke that high. Because, you know, some days you wake up and it's maybe not the perfect conditions and people are busy doing stuff and you just don't have that same kind of riled up energy from being held in a classroom for 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, and you're just a kid at that point too. All they want to do is be on the hill, so I can think the energy is building up all day just to get there. But in thinking about you as a kid, were you a Grom that was super into the scene and had idols that were skiers and non-new schoolers and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so Colin Collins kind of pointed us all in the direction of the Poor Boys films back in the day. Happy Days, Propaganda, Ready, Fire, Aim. First time a lot of us saw those DVDs was borrowing them from Colin. And so naturally we were stoked on guys like C.R. Johnson, Tanner Hall, Pep, Pollard. And yeah, for me, Pep was always someone that I really looked up to, so much to the point that I actually decided to go to the same high school that he went to. The main reason being just that Pep had gone to school there and it worked for him and he was the coolest person in the world. And so I may as well go give it a try myself. So that brought me out to Steamboat Springs, Colorado for 2 years, where I went to the Lowell Whiteman School. And they also had a program where they'd let you out to ski at like 12:30, 4 days a week. And the trend continued.
Your junior and senior year of high school, you're in Steamboat?
I was my sophomore and junior, and then I came back home to graduate with all my buddies. So I did freshman and senior year back home.
Okay. There's a lot of money invested in your skiing and education for you to go to a school like that, because I know those things don't come cheap, and it worked out for you. But when you graduate high school, are you a sponsored skier at that point, or are you kind of looking for sponsors? Are you just living life? Where are you in life at that point?
No, yeah, I'm a little lost in life for sure. Not really having a whole lot going on and trying to figure out what to do. And I'd been out to a few competitions, U.S. Open and stuff like that. Made it through the qualifiers a couple years, but not really made it much further than that, and wasn't able to make too much of a splash on the ski scene or with any sponsors. Scott was giving me a few pair of goggles, but that was kind of just something that was through the Sun Valley ski team. And yeah, I knew that I wanted to ski, and I always had the dream of becoming a pro skier. I wasn't one of those super nonchalant, like, oh, I didn't even have to try. You know, it all just fell into line. I've always wanted it and been working for it. And when I graduated high school, I didn't really have a whole lot going on. That's when I decided to make the move out to Breckenridge, Colorado, and try to compete in the Dew Tour. And I was able to qualify into the Dew Tour that year and then move out to Breckenridge, and had a pretty good year out there, but wasn't really too into the whole Breckenridge scene, just because everyone out there is kind of riding the same run over and over day after day. You know, it's either they go to Keystone, which is one of the flattest mountains I've ever skied, and they ride through the park, and that's a blast, especially when you know, growing up in Sun Valley, we didn't have a terrain park, so we'd go there and be pretty blown away by that stuff. But after living out there for a year, you know, everyone just ski the same run over and over, and skiing's always been about adventure for me and getting out there and being out in the mountains and cruising around. And so I wasn't too into that routine and ended up moving out of Colorado and heading to Utah and enrolling in college out there at the Salt Lake Community College. They call it SLIC.
Okay, so when you're in Breckenridge and you're competing, just knowing you, and I don't know you super well, but you seem like a pretty chill, laid-back dude. It's a dude that likes to be in the mountains, doesn't like high-stress situations. That's my take on it. And how do you do in contests? Do you feel the nerves? Do you feel just like the, I have to win? What is your take on entering a contest?
Yeah, I'm pretty well rehearsed in the contest scene just because I grew up doing all the mogul contests. And when I was a J4 and J5, I was winning pretty much every contest I'd go to. But, you know, it wasn't the stiffest competition looking back. But, you know, I was pretty comfortable in the start gate. And so Dew Tour felt pretty good. It was really intimidating competing against people that you're looking up to. So I had a few competitions where I just totally blow it and crash and burn, and I kind of realized that I was really comparing myself to all these people, thinking, you know, how can someone like me compete with someone like Ewan Olson? And then I started kind of realizing, all right, it's not about comparing yourself to what everyone else is doing. It's just about figuring out what works for you and doing the best that you can do. And so I kind of took that mentality into Dew Tour, and I wasn't invited there, but I showed up and just kind of begged the event organizers there to let me get a spot. And morning of, they ended up having a spot open and they let me jump in there. I got like one quick practice run and then just had to go balls to the wall. But yeah, I was able to qualify with 2 360s in my run. I think a lot of people were crashing, and I just kind of went for the more laid back style approach and ended up getting me into the contest. And so I was able to go out to North Star, and I think they had one at Mount Snow that year, and that was really cool. And maybe $500 each competition I was going to, and you know, I was just starting to see those little bits of cash come in, and yeah, it started to turn around, I guess, around 2009.
Okay, and when did you pick up like your first ski sponsor?
So my first ski sponsor and really my first real sponsor was ON3P. And that was super cool just because that relationship actually just started with a message on newschoolers.com with the owner of ON3P contacting me. I think Scott Skis had given me a couple of pairs of free skis, and they were working out all right, but ON3P seemed like they had a good thing going on, and they contacted me, just a random message through New Schoolers, and I kind of went with it and been riding for them ever since. I think this will either be my fifth or sixth season riding with ON3P, so it's been pretty cool working with those guys.
That brand has grown tremendously, I think, since you signed on with them. They've moved warehouses a couple times, and it's an interesting story of a college project named after an address of where the owner lived. And how is it working with those guys? You get to have a lot of input on your skis, and what's the whole ON3P relationship like?
Yeah, that's the best thing about working with that brand is that they're making all their skis right there in Portland, Oregon, and I'm constantly going in and out of Portland, and so every time I go through, I stop by the factory and get to sit down and talk with the guys who are building the skis and see how they're pressing everything and the different layups that we're working with, and so I have a really good idea of the process of what goes into making a ski and places that we can tweak things and what's an easy tweak and what's a really expensive tweak. And yeah, it's just been incredible to sit down with the owner. And also another one of the athletes, John Ware, is someone I've worked with a lot with ski shaping. And ultimately we ended up making a pro model series called the Cartel line. And right now we started with a 98 and a 106 in that line. And now we're running a 98, a 108 and a 116. And it's been cool to see it evolve. And it's been evolving as my skiing's been evolving. When we first started the pro model, I was riding the 98 and I was a little more park and urban focused. And in the last couple of years, I haven't really been skiing any park or urban at all. And so that's why we made the move to add the POW ski into the line, just for the sheer sake that I wasn't even riding the pro model the last year because I needed something a little wider for all the POW I've been hunting down.
Your career is an interesting one, as a lot of people get into contests, start doing really well in contests, and then are able to go ski powder and say, I don't want to compete anymore. But you did ski in contests, but you were never known as a contest skier by any means. You were just in them. And your career is based on filming, and you didn't have to be a competitive skier or a racer to get into the film world, which is rare. But in thinking about how your career has evolved, one story I heard was that you invited yourself to the Cold Rush in 2012. And somehow got your way into there. How did that whole story evolve? And I heard you guinea pig a railroad trestle and everybody's jaw dropped, and that kind of got the skiers fired up. How did you muscle your way into that?
I was really lucky to have a connection through my cousin Axel, who has been working with Freeride Entertainment for almost 2 decades. And Freeride is the crew that goes and films the Cold Rush. Yeah, in order to get an in with an event like that, you have to know somebody. And so thankfully, I knew my cousin, and he was kind of sticking his neck out there for me, saying, hey, my cousin's got some skills. This is his dream event, anything you guys can do. And so he wasn't able to get me an invite by any means, but finally, he was able to get me a job as a production assistant for him. And so I ended up just going out to Cold Rush, and you know, he said, hey, just show up. Maybe it'll work out, and you can ski. And I showed up there in Silverton and was working as a production assistant for the first day. And that was actually a crazy day. Holy shit, we rolled up. We're some of the first people to the venue that day. They gave us a bunch of snowmobiles to take up there to get all the production equipment set up. And right when we roll up to the venue, this huge chute rips out. And the powder cloud from the slide that ripped out actually went all the way through the finish area. And we all got hit with this huge, just kind of white little, almost like a dust storm type of thing from all the snow coming through. And the crazy thing was there were two main chutes in that venue, and one of them ripped out and the other hadn't ripped out. But the one that did rip out, it took out that Red Bull half semicircle that people ski through at the end of the competition there.
Okay.
And we're on the radio, and like maybe 1 minute after the slide had finished, there were calls on the radio like, hey, like, let's get someone in there to get the Red Bull finish line thing put back up. And like four people rushed right into the run out of this Abbey zone. And there's this other chute that hadn't ripped out yet. So it was kind of all this hang fire sitting there. And yeah, then also this other chute that could rip out. And so after like 2 minutes of these guys trying to fix the little finish line thing, someone gets on the radio and they're like, get those guys the hell out of there. Like, fuck that thing. Like, we can't have them in the runout zone. And then the owner of Silverton ended up coming through and ski cutting the other chute and deemed it all safe to ski, albeit it was pretty bare conditions that year.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to have the competition. And then the next day was the slopestyle day, and they had this crazy sketchy railroad feature that was a rail and a railroad track, and it was meant for grinding, and nobody wanted to hit it. And I was up there with my cousin Pep rolled through, and I kind of had noticed that no one was hitting that thing, and rails are just something that have always come kind of naturally to me. And so I was like, hey, Pep, dude. And I already asked him if he could get me into the competition, and he didn't really know me too well and said, you know, hey, I wish there was something I can do, but there's not really anything I can do. But then I was like, hey, dude, could I please just hit that rail? Like, I'll guinea pig it, man. I think he was kind of like sigh of relief, like, be my guest, man. Get in there. I don't want to hit it.
Yeah.
And I had my powder skis on the time. I'd never hit a rail on them, so I was a little scared that they'd catch up on that thing. But I think I was feeling a little pressure from a childhood hero there and decided to send it and ended up greasing it up and landing it perfect. And then right after that, everyone started sessioning it. And yeah, it was a pretty funky feature. I don't think it was the most well-designed rail feature of all time, but it was cool to see at least everyone hit it in some way or another. Some people just kind of went straight over it, like riding the railroad track, so not grinding the thing.
Okay.
A few guys, Andy Mayer, Pep, Wiley Miller, Colin, a lot of those guys were grinding it and really sending it. And it was pretty sketchy, man. If you kind of came too far off the left, you could just fall off this like couple hundred foot cliff. So
damn.
Very high consequence feature.
And that had to open up a lot of eyes, and I'm sure everyone at that event knew who you were from there on out. And that was just one.
I wish that was the case, but I think Pep was the only one who saw that go down. But it's actually kind of a little bit of a bummer at the end of that competition. I'd got the heli ride up with all the filmers to film everything, and then I was going to go ski this real mellow run down, and I was about to ski down, and one of the guides at Silverton, I didn't really know what the whole deal was there, he starts yelling at me, hey, what the hell are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm just skiing down, I already skied down this run a couple times. He's like, dude, if you ski down right now, I'm calling the sheriff on you, and he'll be sitting at the bottom of the resort waiting to arrest you when you get down.
Damn.
Like, just kind of thrown off. And so the guy actually ended up making me ride the chairlift back down. I had to ride the chair down at the end of the cold rush, and so it was kind of a buzzkill ender to the whole thing. Wanting to be in competition so bad and going out there and helping with the production crew and then just have such a buzzkill ender is, I kind of left that event actually a little bummed out, but it's all good. It's a cool event. I'd still like to compete in it someday if it ever came back, but I don't think it's the Shangri-La of backcountry contest. I think there's still a lot of room for evolution and progression in the realm of a backcountry contest.
I agree with you there, and I think one thing I've learned from talking to you so far is you won't let anything get in your way. You went to Breckenridge. There wasn't a spot for you on the Dew Tour, and you forced your way into the Dew Tour. You wanted to be at the Cold Rush. There wasn't an invite for you there. You forced your way into that, given the end of that trip wasn't great. I mean, that's what it takes to be successful and make things happen for yourself, and you've done that. Your early film career, it was all about urban, and anybody can go and find the videos on the internet of you skiing urban, and there's not a feature you couldn't hit, and it seems like when you land big drops, your body doesn't buckle like you see in a lot of things, and that's with all your landings, whether it's in deep pow or urban features. But there was one trip in particular, the Tracing Skylines trip to Detroit, which is a really sketchy trip, and just want to get your take a couple years after the fact of how scary that was. Was your life really in danger, and tell me about that.
Yeah, man, that was a crazy trip, and there's supposed to be a couple other poor boys athletes that were going to join, and there wasn't any snow out there, and so everyone ended up bailing, and I was kind of the new guy on the squad, and Cody Carter and Jasper Newton had already driven across country with the winch and all the urban gear to get out there, and kind of just started with poor boys, and I wanted to keep things going. Those guys had already driven across country, so I was just like, fuck it, dude, there'll be more pow, I'll go out there and just see what happens. And the first couple days we just drove around looking at stuff, and it all looked pretty bleak and didn't seem like there was going to be much to come out of the trip. And then finally we went into this abandoned church, and there was this sweet balcony section, and there was a big old snowbank a couple blocks away. I think Detroit had gotten like 4 inches of snow like a few weeks before we showed up. So they, all the big parking lots where the plow had come in, there was all this old rotten snowbank snow.
Okay.
And finally we're just like, we can't just sit around here doing nothing. Let's see if we can't import snow into this church and make a little bomb drop off the balcony inside there. And that ended up working out great. And from there, we just kept rolling with it. And eventually we did get a little bit of snow, and everything just escalated to the point where every day we were coming home and looking at these shots we were getting and just blown away by what we were capturing down there. And it was kind of cool. The whole attitude of the trip there kind of went from like, what the hell are we doing to, holy shit, this is actually turning out pretty cool. And Cody was working with a Red camera. I think it was the first trip that he was working as a Red operator, and he's definitely doing the features justice with that. And we just had got a whole lot of momentum rolling, and we kind of had a couple sketchy instances, but overall it was actually pretty low-key being out there. I don't know if I'd want to do it again, but it was a cool experience.
So there was one part where you say it wasn't that sketchy, but there's one part they kind of focus on your face and you look totally dejected, scared, and you're driving by a truck with some guys in ski masks that you figure are going to go steal your gear. That made you guys actually stop skiing in the city for a few days, I believe. So it had to be a little more than it was just a little sketchy.
Yeah, well, there were a couple days where we kind of realized we were getting in over our head, and that was one of those days. And what ended up happening there was we were going to this old abandoned hospital to do a little stall on the awning outside the hospital. It kind of had this cool reflective coating. Was going to make a great photo for Nate Abbott. And showed up there, we just start piling all these pallets and broken doors and just anything we can get our hands on. While we're doing that, Cody and one of these random New Schooler kids he found via New Schoolers to help us build stuff. They were off filling the truck with snow, and they're going to bring in, you know, 4, 5, 6 truckloads of snow to fill the form of our jump. And while we were doing that, some kind of sketchy looking guy comes by, and he's, you know, he's like, hey, you guys can't be here. You got to get out of here. And we're like, we kind of like call his bluff, and we're like, you know, like, just call the cops, man. Like, that's all right. He's like, no, you guys shouldn't be here. He kind of drives away all sketchy, and we're kind of wondering like, okay, like what's going on? And then another truck shows up, this guy looking a little more official, and he claims to be the building manager. And, you know, he's, hey, you guys got to get out of here. And so we have a few tactics for situations like that. You know, we'll offer to pay him a couple $100 to let us stay or all that. And then finally, he's not having it. And so we just call his bluff too. We're like, all right, man, we'll just call the cops on us. And he's like, that's not going to work out. And so we're kind of sitting there bickering with this guy. And then this must have been like an old, like late 90s diesel Ford truck. And these guys come ripping into the parking lot. And they kind of drive by just perfect where they roll down the back window. And there's, I can't remember if there are 2 or 3 guys in the back, but they all have ski masks and are strapped. Once that happened, we're like, oh shit, we got to get the fuck out of here. So we just throw all our gear in, and Nate Abbott's there. He's like got all his flash photography gear and all that. And he's like extra freaked out. And he like forgot some gear. He's like pulling out and going out to like grab it. But he was like trying to move so fast, he forgot to put his minivan back into park when he went to hop out of the car. So he's like trying to rush around, get all his gear, hops out of a car. He starts ghost riding the whip, throws it in park. And then we have the New Schoolers kid. I just hopped in his car. He's the closest vehicle. And we peeling out of the lot. And the guys in the truck try to play a game of chicken with us, getting out of the lot, dude. So we're going head on right into these guys and just barely swerve and miss them. And then we all 3 peel out in different directions. It was definitely fight or flight kind of situation, and we were just trying to get the hell out of there. Anyhow, in the aftermath, we ended up talking to some local shops and people, and we found out that the whole hospital was under control of the Detroit Highway Gang. And so they were using the facility. I don't know if they're running drugs through there or what they were doing, but it was their turf, and we were there just ignorantly trying to slam ourselves into the awning.
You don't really hear too much of that at a resort or in the backcountry, but in the cities you do.
Yeah, we were in over our heads, that's for sure. Didn't know what we were getting ourselves into.
Bunch of kids from Sun Valley in the hood in Detroit, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Bunch of white boys from Sun Valley.
Your skiing has definitely evolved. There was a period where it was mostly urban and park for you, if not all urban and park. And then I'm sure you were skiing powder when you weren't being filmed in the park. Now you've taken your skiing, it seems like, a lot more to finding powder and in the search of powder. Last year was the Tamashii project with Ross Reed and crew. And that was an interesting project where you went to Japan for 5 weeks and you were totally going to get rid of social media and cut yourselves off from the world. So it was the real world with no technology and 6 or 7 of you. And what was that like? Did you guys turn on each other? Was there a lot of emotions running high, 5 of you or 6 of you being stuck in one area?
Yep. No, emotions weren't running too high. That was a dream come true. I mean, the whole idea cast, Pollard, Mayer, and Pep, and Ben Chetler too. I know he's kind of came in a little further down the line, but those 4 guys have really been the guys that, to me, have kind of evolved the sport in the right direction. And that's kind of the type of skiing that I adhere to. But that was just crazy because the year before that, I got to go out and go to Japan with Lexi DuPont and Andy Mayer. And that was a dream come true, getting to especially getting to ride with Mayer, just because, you know, I'd grown up watching his segments, and you know, his segments were some of my favorite back in the day. And then to get the chance to go back to the Shangri-La of POW with one of the all-time best POW skiers, and Andy Mayer, was just crazy to go for 5 weeks. And then to get Anna Seagal on the trip too was awesome. She rips it up and super fun girl to be cruising around with. And we had a really good crew dynamic. And then it was just kind of what sort of story we're trying to tell behind the social media, because obviously there are a lot of good things that social media brings and a lot of bad. So anyhow, when we first got over there, we're trying to get our bearings straight. And so we're still using our iPhones to load up maps and send emails and all that, and then kind of figuring out what the whole story is that we're trying to tell, because I think Ross had a pretty definite idea in mind. You know, we kind of understood the story that he was trying to tell, but we weren't 100% certain. So we're just trying to roll with it. And the whole point of being there is to ski powder. But obviously, we're kind of also very open to the idea of discussing how social media affects our lives. And, you know, it's pretty fun to talk with your parents, just people that were born before 1990, and welcome some of those struggles to see what kind of experiences would come out of them. So yeah, we just deleted the Facebook accounts and Instagram and all that, which I don't think for anyone, they were like, oh my God, whole month without Facebook. I think that was all pretty easy thing. But I think like once we got rid of it all, and it was like, well, damn, like I want to send my mom an email and like let her know I'm doing all right. And, you know, I want to contact some of my buddies that have been to this zone in Japan in the past and ask them about all this stuff. And so I think what we really gained out of the whole thing was just realizing how much more prepared you have to be when you don't have the iPhone at your fingertips, where you have to actually have all your maps printed out and have all your zones figured out. And you can't just call up your buddy and just be like, hey, you dropped me a pin on that epic pillow line that you're talking about. And so when you don't have that luxury, you know, it is a little bit harder. And so it forced us to kind of see the land in a different way. And yeah, I think all of us were, you know, I was like, dude, I don't care about this whole social media thing. I care about getting to this pillow line. So I'd kind of sneak off and shoot off an email to get the beta. But in retrospect, it's like, I should have been doing that a month before the trip, but that would have been in December, and that's already a hectic enough time of year. And so, yeah, I think it's crazy just how reliant we are now on our iPhones, and pretty awesome, but it can cripple you a little bit too. It's kind of like you have an external hard drive for your brain sitting at your fingertips, pretty much impossible to shut down and cut off. But yeah, getting rid of Facebook and Instagram, that was the easy stuff.
So Tamashii was a project where you were in Japan for a while and skiing powder. Before that, you spent your time skiing urban, and then this summer you took a different turn and you skied the woods of Welch's, Oregon, and hopefully that was a big paycheck for you doing Triple X. What goes into a production like that?
Yeah, that was crazy, and I could go off on a pretty wild story from that if you have the time.
Let's do it.
It all started with Valhalla, which I know you're familiar with, and hopefully most of everyone who's listening to this has seen that film. If you haven't, definitely check it out.
It's amazing.
By far one of the best films that's come out in recent years, in my opinion, and I only had a very small role in that. Lucky enough to get the chance to be a part of that ski film, even though I didn't even ski any, well, I guess we skied a little bit of real snow, but yeah, they had that situated out in Glacier, Washington, just outside of Mount Baker, and they had this pretty cool concept where they wanted to have us skiing through the green woods of Washington in the summertime, kind of supposed to be like a dreamy sequence. And what we ended up doing is going up to Mount Baker and getting trucks full of snow and devising these shots where it would look like we're skiing through summertime woods, green, luscious, beautiful looking, but with no snow.
Right.
And sometimes there actually was no snow, and other times we'd make little tracks and jumps where we'd put just an inch layer of snow on top of it and just shoot it side profile where the ferns would kind of cover that stuff up.
Okay.
Someone from Triple X, the Vin Diesel Chronicle, saw that segment and contacted Sweetgrass to see if they could bring those guys onto a Hollywood shoot to film Vin Diesel skiing through the jungle in the Dominican Republic. And so I got the call to go on that shoot from Mike Brown over at Sweetgrass Productions, and said it was going to be a great paying job. And I wouldn't like to consider myself a sellout by any means, but if you can make that much money in that short of a time and also gain some kind of work experience at the same time, it just seemed like a cool opportunity.
You have to sell before you sell out.
Yeah, and you got to sell out to eat out.
Yeah, true.
anyhow, I was kind of intrigued by this job, so I agreed to go down there for kind of a consult and see what they wanted to do. And we got the call to go to the Dominican Republic, and sounded like a cool opportunity, at least worth investigating. So I ended up going out there. And when we first show up, it's kind of unclear how we're going to meet up with the whole production staff and everything. And eventually we meet up with the guys, and we're sitting at this big table with all these Hollywood big shots, and it's just like scumbag central. I hate to just speak poorly of those guys, but I just sat down at a table and was like, wow, I'm surrounded by scumbags right now. And it's very important not to confuse scumbag with dirtbag, because those are two entirely different entities.
Okay.
Dirtbags are just kind of people scraping by, doing what they got to do to live their passion, in my mind. And scumbag is someone who's just Hollywood scumbag. Who knows what kind of shit they're going on. It was crazy, dude. They have all these prostitutes in the Dominican Republic, and all these people on the production crew are getting prostitutes, and we all hear like people are getting cocaine, and we're just like, what the hell do we get ourselves into? And then we go to the venue to see where they want us to shoot, and it's just like the steepest, gnarliest, cliffy, corally slope that you've ever seen, and we're just like, dude, are these guys high? Like, what the hell do they think we're going to do here? And the main director, Dan Bradley, who's supposedly pretty well-renowned, did Spider-Man stunts and all that, is just saying, hey, I want to tie you up on this winch and hang you from cables and have you jump off this cliff, and we're going to catch you before you hit. Going like, what in the hell are you guys smoking? Anyhow, we're checking out this whole set that they want to shoot on, and there's 15 Hollywood big shots cruising around, and so I'm kind of just biting my tongue. It's day one on the scene, just hearing them all out, and then they send us back to the zone the next day to like get a better idea of what kind of features we can set up there, because you know we're trying to say, all right, they're paying us good money, let's see what we can figure out here.
Yep.
So we're going all around this whole cliffy corally zone where it's like just impossible to ski, and we're just kind of thinking, all right, these guys, I think we tricked them a little too well with the Valhalla edit. And anyhow, we're cruising around trying to make the best out of the situation, and we're there all day, and about probably 5 o'clock, they have pretty short twilight there. It's so close to the equator. But we remember like, oh yeah, there's this one other zone Dan Bradley wanted us to go investigate. We're like, well, we know we're not going to do anything over there, but just to keep them happy, we'll go over and check it out. And so we kind of sneak into the woods there, and I take a little different route than the other guys did, and kind of step in this, I hate to use the word squishy, but it's kind of squishy. Felt like I stepped in a pile of compost.
Okay.
And then I look down and I see this, I see a bone, and I see a hatchet, and then like a zipper for a hoodie, and then it all just clicks, dude. I'm standing right next to a decomposing body.
No
human
way.
Body.
Gnarly.
And I'm just like, what the fuck, you guys? There's a dead body over here. I'm out of here. This is fuck. And they're kind of like, yeah, bullshit. And I'm like, dude, you guys don't even want this image in your mind, but if you don't believe me, go give it a look. So they walk over. I'm like 50 feet away at this point, just getting ready to GTFO.
Yeah.
So they roll over, and sure enough, they see like a razor cell phone, like femur bone, all this stuff. And it's just me, Mike Brown, and Zach Ramross. Mike and Zach are the two Sweetgrass filmers, and this one Dominican local that was with us. And the local, I guess, picks up a stick and starts like poking the body, and then he like tries to pick the hoodie up. Oh man, Mike's gonna hate that I'm telling this story, but he's like poking the thing with a stick, and then he's trying to lift the sweater up. He like almost gets it, there's a little tension, and then the stick slips, dude, and it just flings all this decaying matter all over Mike Brown. We're like, oh man. So we like take a couple photos, get out of there, and then we get back to the road, a little walk back to the road, and then Mike realizes he forgot his notebook where he's kept everything with all the work we'd done up there that day. So at that point it's like pitch dark. He's got to go back through this private property to go get his notebook that's next to the dead body. We kind of split crews at that point. Two of us stayed at the road, two went in. And yeah, at that point, I pretty much had to call it quits on that project. I think I made like $1,000 going out there for like 4 days. And I heard that they kind of screwed me over. I think the production staff didn't like me out there too much, but I just got cold feet and had to bail on that situation after all that went down. And they ended up pulling the project off. Cody Townsend, LJ Stranio, and Sandy Bovell ended up going out there, and they all made a shit ton of cash, more than I even thought they were going to be able to make. And so it was definitely a good move on their part. I think they're only there a week or two and made like half a year's salary for a normal person.
That's pretty awesome.
So then Sweetgrass, I guess, got contacted by the Hollywood folk again to do another project that's supposed to be like an online promotion where there's like one new guy who's trying to become a XXX agent and he has to outrun all these bad guys skiing through the jungle. And we talked him into letting us shoot it in Oregon instead of the Dominican Republic. And this project was more like Sweetgrass getting subcontracted to film the project rather than Sweetgrass getting brought onto the whole Hollywood production crew.
Okay.
So it was super low key, a lot more like the Valhalla thing, but with the whole chase scene. So LJ Stranio was the good guy, and then me, Cody Townsend, and Thane Rich were the bad guys chasing LJ through the woods. And we found a pretty good formula out there in Welch's, and there's so much decomposing plants and trees and everything out there. The ground's really spongy, and so you kind of get in there and get rid of all the rocks and stumps and suspect stuff, and then you can kind of let it rip and hot dog through all these fern bushes. So it was even a little bit of fun, and yeah, way better vibe than the Dominican Republic Hollywood thing. So I don't know if I'm gonna be doing any more Hollywood projects, but the one in Welch's with Sweetgrass producing it was cool. I mean, it was still Paramount that produced it, but it was Sweetgrass doing it.
Yeah, and you stick with the ski companies and the skiers, and you're around people that you're used to, and I think that's how those things work out. When they bring 10 trucks and 100 people for production, that's when things get crazy.
Yeah. Oh man, just how wasteful that whole production is. That was pretty depressing to see, just such a chaotic shit show, the Hollywood thing. So I think I'll be avoiding those situations. But yeah, man, it was good job experience, and the Welch's thing was a blast. We had a big old house, everyone posted up, and it kind of felt like a ski trip just without all the pow.
Nice. Well, what's next? What are you going to be filming for this year?
So yeah, we're still working with a good company, and let's see, I'll be working with Jasper Newton is kind of our main backcountry filmer with a good company. And then we have Thane Rich, John Ware, Tim McChesney gets out with us quite a bit. Wallace will come out and get his sled out and hit some pow booters from time to time. And then big thing this year is we're bringing on Lucas Walks, who's super talented up and coming backcountry free skier out of Bend, Oregon. And so we're really excited to work with him. And yeah, we're just going to be storm chasing all year long.
So you heard it there from Carl. He is going to be searching for powder all year long, and he is doing it with a stack crew, and it'll be great to see what they put together. Carl, I want to thank you very much for being on the show, and looking forward to see what you put together this season.
All right. Thanks, Powell. And hey, next time we do a podcast, we'll have to talk about Powder Awards last year.
Yep, we can definitely talk about that. And I think there's a lot more I want to talk to you about. Sandboarding, I think, is going to be a future for you. There's a lot of things that I've learned about you that we could talk about. We just don't have the time.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time, Powell, and always good to chat with you, and keep doing what you're doing. I've been driving a bunch and listening to all your podcasts, and I love hearing it all. And yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
So that was time with Crazy Carl, Carl Fosvet, and he's really a well-rounded, good dude. It was nice talking with him, and he had some funny stories to share. We have more with Carl over on Inappropriate Questions on thepowellmovement.com. Carl will answer three questions from Clayton Vila, then he'll put together three questions for Caroline Gleick. And as always, if you have any feedback for me, you can reach me at PowellMovement1 on Twitter or Mike@thepowellmovement.com on the old email. I hope everybody had an amazing Christmas or Hanukkah and are ready for a phenomenal 2017. Thanks, and have a great week, everybody.